Okay, and now for something completely different. So I'd like to thank my fellow co-organisers for their dedication and hard work and fundraising abilities to make this workshop and this conference happen. It's nice to be back at ITP 20 years after the original Pattern Formation Programme, where I was actually a postdoc with Jim Langer. In those days we were working on dendrites, and we wanted to understand very simplest pattern formation systems. And we were interested in dendrites per se, but we also had a more lofty goal, one that we saw as more lofty, which was to try to understand something about the fundamentals of non-equilibrium dynamical systems and pattern-forming processes. Now, this time around, 20 years later, we're all interested in various aspects of biological systems, and again, we also have a lofty goal there, which I'm going to try to talk about a little bit in my talk, not just specific problems, but trying to understand something something special about biological systems. Biological systems are especially interesting to physicists because the problem of what you choose to work on is especially important. In physics, you have a few problems and you really need to go into them very deeply in order to get to the frontiers of knowledge and to really try to make progress. But biology seems to be somewhat different in that it's very broad and very shallow, and that means that problem selection is a very important part of what one needs to do as a physicist. So that's why we have here many people talking about different things, and I'm going to talk about a completely new area that I think you've not heard about before, which I think is quite fascinating and will be quite rich in years to come. Now, this talk, as my first slide shows, is not so much a final report, it's more a postcard from the front. So this is a work in progress, but I thought I'd like to talk about this because it is already intriguing and we already have some interesting results. So this is the first talk that I've ever given where there won't be any equations, and all the modeling will appear in a later talk. Hopefully given towards the end of this workshop. Okay, so this is what we're going to be talking about. These pictures shown in this sketch here of terraces, travertine terraces at Yellowstone National Park. They occur other places in the world, as I'll show you, but we're going to try to understand the pattern formation processes that cause these very characteristic structures, about which later. Let me start off by thanking my co-workers in geology and microbiology, Bruce Falk, George Bonheiro, and Jorge Frias Lopez. Bruce is in fact, I think, the only geology professor in the United States who has a microbiology lab. I've also worked with two students, Hector Garcia Martin and John Vasey, and this summer, if I get time to talk about this work, with Tracy Van Gundy and Joanna Metz on some laboratory experimental work. Actually, since I'm colorblind, I can't see this, so I'll use this if you don't mind. Now, at what time is this talk supposed to end?
Okay.
So I want to start off then by talking to you about geobiology and why I think it's an interesting subject. It's an example of what's come to be known by this trendy word biocomplexity. And so I want to spend a bit of time, at the beginning at least, just talking about what biocomplexity is and what physicists can contribute to that. And then I'm going to give you a tour of Yellowstone's hot springs. These are the hot springs at Mammoth Terrace, which at Yellowstone, which is in fact the world's largest volcanic center. And I'm going to give you an introduction to what sedimentary geologists call the facies concept. And then I'm going to get to the heart of my talk and the question that I'm really most interested in, which is the idea that microbes may be involved in pattern formation. That geological structures that we've always taken for granted as forming through physical and sedimentary processes may in fact arise through the interactions of life with the geological structures, and in particular microbes. And in fact, in the last couple of years, there's been at least one very exciting development in that direction, the understanding of the formation of caves like Carlsberg Caverns, which for a long time was thought of as being a purely physical process and is now understood to be intimately connected with the motion of microbes that actually eat rocks and dissolve them away. And so microbes are turning out in the geological world to be quite revolutionary in terms of their impact on geological environment. I'm going to talk about field work that we've done to actually try to understand and characterize the microbial ecology and as a first step to understanding their interaction with the pattern formation at Yellowstone. And then at the end, if I get time, I'll talk a little bit about early work that we've been doing this summer, laboratory work, trying to actually make laboratory simulations of some of these pattern formation processes occurring at Yellowstone. So let me just talk about biocomplexity. The biocomplexity arises in many different fields of biology. Some of these things are talked about here. This is a slime mold. This is the things I'm going to talk about. This is an example, a picture of systems biology. It's a tropical rainforest. So what basically do we mean by biocomplexity? Well, complexity, if you like, can be thought of as being a dynamical system which exhibits some kind of structure, but also has very large fluctuations, which and maybe the involvement of chaotic dynamics, which makes the characteristic complex dynamics. The big idea, of course, is that the research on the individual components of a complex system provides only limited information about the behavior of the system. You really need to understand everything holistically. What biocomplexity is the complexity that arises from the interplay of biological, physical, and even social systems. So the best definition that I've seen from this, and perhaps even one that may even inspire people, surprisingly comes from a National Science Foundation solicitation, probably the only time that's ever happened. Biocomplexity arises from dynamics spanning several levels within a system, between systems and or across multiple spatial scales, ranging from microns to thousands of kilometers, and temporal scales ranging from nanoseconds to eons. That's very intriguing for people from our community who are interested in processes operating simultaneously on many different scales. In fact, the NSF was interested in looking to encourage people to explore nonlinearities, chaotic dynamics, emergent phenomena and feedbacks within and between these systems, and integrate them across multiple components and scales of time and space in order to better understand and predict the dynamical behavior of systems. So this is very much a sort of buzzword that the physics community was interested in a few years ago, over the last 20 years or so, but this work is being asked now to be addressed towards biological systems. And this is a big deal. And as you can see, the NSF, the Directorate for Biological Sciences, is interested, computer and information sciences, engineering, geosciences, math and physical sciences, social, behavioral, and economic sciences, Office for Polar Programs. There's a very widespread understanding in the biological community that these types of knowledge about dynamical systems, the sorts of things that physicists have been applying on very simple systems, actually do have something to say to biologists. Why do they care? Perhaps the most amusing article that I've read for a couple of years was this one in the New York Times, February the 19th, 2001. A couple of days before that, the human genome results were announced, and Stephen Jay Gould was astonished, as with many other people, at the small number of genes that we have. Only a few more genes, half as many genes again, as tiny worms. And this really was quite a shock to many biologists, because the idea that you have one gene for one protein and the direction of causal flow from the genes to the phenotype, that really just doesn't happen in reality. What makes biology rich and interesting is in fact the failure of reductionism. And so he's actually seeking the involvement of physicists and people who understand emergent properties and dynamical systems. So that's my plug for the biocomplexity as a discipline and why I'm interested in it. This is in fact so interesting that it's an NSF priority area, along with nanoscience and information technology. And those of you who are writing grant proposals, it's dispersed many millions of dollars over the last few years, and some of the people here in the audience are my fellow co-organizers and our group at Illinois are beneficiaries of that. So now let me talk about geobiology. Geobiology, what these are biocomplexity studies conducted in the geological context, permits results of studies in modern environments to be applied to ancient environments in deep geological time. So what does that really mean? What that means is, can we understand how biological processes have interacted with geological processes right now, and then can we look back in the geological record and say, well, these processes that we previously thought were physical, in fact, are actually biological, or perhaps vice versa, and that can help us understand something about the origins of life on this planet. This is a picture here of Grand Prismatic Spring at Yellowstone National Park, and this is a hot spring. This is a vent. The water is coming up out of the ground, out of this big pool here. The beautiful colors that you see are due to microorganisms. Even though this water is virtually boiling, there are microbes in here which love the heat, love the sulfur content, love the absolutely inhospitable environment for everything else. And these microbes form these mats and so on, which you can see in these beautiful colors. And there's a very strong interaction at places like at these volcanic places like Yellowstone, and deep sea vents between microbes and the.
I may admit that they tolerate it. Do you know that they love it?
They love it.
You know that.
They thrive on it. They don't like it when you change it. Now this is the system that we're actually exploring now as we get down into detail. So this stuff here, this white stuff, is called travertine. It's basically calcium carbonate. It's basically many buildings in ancient Rome, for example, are built out of travertine. It's one of the most useful rocks in the world, although it's one of the least studied by geologists. And travertine is formed when the water comes out of the ground up at the vent up here, flows downhill, and then the process of formation causes travertine to be precipitated, and these rocks grow into forming this cascade of terraces. And it's a literal cascade, as you can see. And in fact, the water forms these pools. It dribbles out, it precipitates, it dribbles out, it goes over the random landscape. The colors that you can see are due to microbial mats. This fuzzy stuff in the middle here is steam, because this water is coming out of the ground at the place that we were, that we're studying. It comes out at about 73 degrees centigrade. So this is the structure, a very random structure. But you can see that there is a very familiar motif that is repeated at varying length scales in the structure throughout the structure, ranging on scales from, in fact, of all the kilometers down to about millimeters. So this is the phenomenon we wish to explore. These are some other views of it. These are in Turkey at Pamukkale. So these are, again, these terraces showing you have this cascade of steps. These are pools here. We'll show you those in more detail in a little while. Here again, you can see something of the nature of the cascade. Here you can see a kind of simulacrum of the larger scale pools repeated down to a smaller scale over here. And this process continues ad infinitum. This is a nice sort of aerial view so that you can see the pond lips. These are pictures, in fact, after the pools have dried out, because what happens is these spring systems, once they precipitate the carbonate gets in the way of the flowing water that's carrying the carbonate, and so the water itself is diverted, and so the spring system, as it grows, changes the local geometry, and the water changes direction. So let me tell you about what the geological timescale is here. The geological timescale for these kinds of systems is about 2 months. Okay, so we go back to our site, we leave it for about 4 months in the summer while the tourists are there. When we come back, it looks different. We're going to be making time-lapse photographs of the dynamics of these pools so that we can actually see, really try to probe quantitatively the space-time dynamics of this geological system. This is another view. Again, this is a Turkey. These are perhaps the most spectacular and perhaps the most famous travertine pools in the world. The only reason that we're not doing our work in Turkey is this. These pools are visited by tourists, and they're completely contaminated by all sorts of things that are totally uncontrolled. Only at Yellowstone National Park, which is a protected
biological-geological interaction.
Yeah, well, we want it to be controlled. So we're doing our field work here at Yellowstone. So this is at the corner of Wyoming and Montana. And the specific place that we have permission to work is a place called Mammoth Hot Springs. So this is in fact our site. We actually have to work here in a way that we're not visible to tourists. That's part of our permit. So we have to hide in the trees, and we're actually allowed to go out and take samples. And in fact, what we've done is we take water samples throughout this whole drainage system. We go and take rock samples. We cut pieces away. So it's a kind of surreal, because when you're out there doing field work, you're standing in a pool of water which is about 73 degrees. It's snowing, so you're having to wear thermal Arctic gear, as it were, and you've got hot steam and goodness knows what blowing in your face, and there's a very odd smell. So it's quite interesting to do this. You have to like doing this kind of thing. It's not for everyone. But it beats sitting in front of a computer terminal. Here you can see this is the main vent, and then down here you can see a very small scale. This is on a scale of perhaps 10 centimeters or so, a whole range of pools. If I were able to take a picture of this and blow this up, I haven't done that in this talk. I didn't have the pictures with me, unfortunately. But you would see that the morphology is anecdotally scale invariant. We haven't quantified that yet. That's something that we will be doing in the coming months. And let me just tell you about some of the pond features, because the dynamics of how these things form is actually quite complicated, although I think that ultimately there is a very simple way to study them. So here is, there's a variety of temperatures as you go down this drainage basin. You get ponds that occur on many scales, and some of these have been pointed out here. This is a big pond here, down there. You get very high deposition rates, up to millimeters per day. If you look into these ponds, I'll show you a picture in a minute, you'll see little needle-like shrubs, like little mushrooms, that form during the precipitation processes. You get ice sheets of calcite that form on the surface. They sort of freeze across, as it were, then they collapse and sink and settle to the bottom, nucleate more material that grows from that. You get calcified air bubbles that you can sometimes see in these things, and you get ridge networks of calcite and aragonite at lower temperatures. The basic physics that drives this is degassing. So what's happening is that the water is coming out with a large amount of calcium embedded in it. Carbon dioxide is produced. Carbon dioxide outgasses, deposits the calcium carbonate. That's the source of the reaction that causes this precipitation process. So here are some of the ice sheets that I mentioned to you. They cover the ponds and then they sink in. Now this is the pond lip, and here are these shrub-like growths, which you'll see more of later on. The length scale here, this length scale is about 2 centimeters, something like that. Sorry, I should have put that on this. On the edge of the ponds, you see another sequence of things that we've called microterasets. This is a scale over here. If you again look at these, you'll see that these microterasets actually mimic the large-scale morphology. It's somewhat different, but it's a very similar kind of process. However, here the flow direction is almost virtually vertical. This is on the edge of one of the ponds.
The question is, does the structure basically arise because of ablation or because of preferential buildup?
What was the first thing?
Ablation by the water.
No, it's preferential buildup.
Preferential.
Yes. So if you took a cross section of the ponds, you get something like this, and we're going to talk now about a concept called facies, which is something that geologists, sedimentary geologists, have used. But people who study this kind of system have not used. Now, because this system evolves in time so rapidly, you have, if you're going to look at the microbial ecology or the water chemistry at any given point, you've got to be in a sort of co-moving frame along with the system. So you need a way to be able to say, well, where am I in the system? And so you need a characterization of different morphologies in the drainage system. And so we can talk about a pond facies. Then there's a facies that goes over here called the proximal slope. So the word facies just basically means region. So this is the pond, this is a pond lip. Then you go into another region. And these regions are distinct, as I'll show you. This is another region, another facies called the apron channel, where you have fingers of microbes. These are Acrophicales microbes that have become encrusted with aragonite, and they form these fingers here, which gradually creep across the pond. And if you go and make a section through one of these ponds, then what you find is you can basically divide it up. Not completely arbitrarily, because you can see all these boundaries with your eyes into these different facies, five different facies characterized by different ranges of temperatures, different ranges of pH, different concentrations and forms of carbonate precipitation. If you take those shrubs that I showed you, those mushroom things, you'll see structures which look like this, feathery types of structures which look, if you look at enough of these pictures, you can convince yourself that you see pictures that look a little bit like the sort of DLA type pictures that you've seen before. This is an example of a block that we leave in different places in the pond. Then we can measure the growth rate by looking at the encrustation that occurs at a given time. So this is really living geology with these sorts of growth rates. It's living geology for another reason, because of all the microbes that are present in the water. And so this is a picture just to show you how rich this system is in microbes. In trying to model this kind of system and its dynamics, there are a whole range of different variables under different classes. Geological variables, things that geologists normally think about to do with sedimentation, geochemistry, crystal structure, porosity, precipitation rates. Physical variables like temperature, pressure, flow rate, and so on and so forth. And then even we have to now start worrying about microbiology, the population, colonization, biochemistry, gene expression, and transport. And I'm going to just show you some of the results that we have on addressing how the microbes are affecting the environment. So the main scientific question we want to understand is the role of microbes versus the environment. Can the microbes locally alter the carbon dioxide concentration enough so that actually drives large-scale degassing, and that large-scale degassing then leads to the crystallization and the geomorphology? That's one scenario, and as I'll show you, there's some evidence for that. Microbial cells could also act as passive or active nucleation sites for precipitation, so that would be a kind of passive way that biology could affect the dynamics here. Not a terribly interesting way, but nevertheless important. And then there's the question of how one can model the landscape evolution. And I'm not going to talk about this today, because I'm not ready to do that, but one can try to write down generic models that describe the stochastic evolution of a landscape, taking into account fluid flow, crystallization, and perhaps the geochemical activity of microbes. I'm not going to mention about the fossils. Let me now tell you something about the water chemistry. The water chemistry is primarily determined by carbon dioxide degassing. So here, again, I'm not going to explain these strange units that geologists use, but this is a sort of carbon 13 content as a function of dissolved inorganic carbon. And if you calculate what that should be based on known sort of chemical equilibrium concentration theory, then you find that actually the C13 content does indeed follow the theoretical prediction for the different facies. So we do actually understand at that level what the water chemistry is doing. However, if you look at the isotopic fractionation, what you find is that it's disequilibrated. So this is as a function of temperature. This is what you would expect in equilibrium, and this is what you actually measure in the field. And what we've found is that there is an anomalously low level of C13 concentration as a function of temperature. And this indicates that the system is not in equilibrium, even though the water chemistry should generally be in equilibrium. So this is an isotopic fractionation. And because it's an isotopic fractionation, it immediately leads you to the idea that this is a biologically driven disequilibrium. There's other evidence for that. If you look at the saturation state at each facies, so again, think of this number here as basically telling you whether you're supersaturated or undersaturated. This is as a function of space. This is going through the facies. What you find is that you get undersaturated as you go into the facies near the vent. And that happens to coincide with the bacteria changing their character between whether they live by absorbing chemicals and light over here to over here being basically parasitic. So there seems to be a change in the saturation state depending upon the nature of the bacteria that are present in the different facies. Now, how do we know what bacteria are present? Well, so what we've done is gone through each of the different facies, collect water samples, and then taken samples and basically genetically analyzed the microbes to see what's there, then compared those with sequences on GenBank. And so that way we can find out what types of species we have. Now, we run into a very interesting problem of biocomplexity, which is the question of what do you mean by species? So normally, you would say, well, a species could be defined solely by the gene sequence, but that's something that's much too restrictive. So what you need to do then is define something called an operational taxonomic unit, where you basically look at a part of the gene sequence, a part that is conserved, the 16S rRNA sequence, and you look at the percentage similarity between different genomes. And if the percentage similarities differ by a fixed amount, let's say 1% or 0.5% or 3%, then you say you have a different operational taxonomic unit, or colloquially a different species. We can't culture the microbes at Mammoth Hot Springs because, as was pointed out, they just love their nasty environment and they don't like the sorts of environments where people like to do culturing. So you're really forced into doing this kind of genomic analysis, which I'm going to skip over. So let me skip over the how you do that. What you end up with is the following type of picture. So this is the horizontal axes here are the different facies. And this are the different numbers of OTUs that are found in that particular facies. And the way this chart has been arranged is to show you that it's basically diagonal.
Sorry, what is the number of OTUs?
So this is how many species there are in these particular facies, and what the species are is defined by how they are here. So, for example, this species here is present in this species and in this one. But these ones are ones that are not present over here. That's the meaning
so
of.
So it's an
chart.
Arbitrary listing.
It's an arbitrary listing, but we've identified and diagonalized it. So the main thing that you can see is that remarkably the species track the facies. So there's only two species. In fact, that occur in all five facies. So there is a partitioning. So it's quite extreme in partitioning. Now, of course, this can happen for several reasons. Well, first thing is we may not have sampled all the microbes present in a given facies. So the incomplete sampling may cause us to conclude that we've got all the species are partitioned when, in fact, we just haven't detected half the samples. So actually what we did was we kind of did a finite-size scaling analysis to test the convergence of the sampling. And the end result of that is that you can basically measure the convergence of your sampling process and therefore sort of extrapolate to find out what the number of OTUs should be. And I'm not going to go through the details of that. But the end result is that you can put error bars on what the numbers of species are in the different facies, and you get a graph that looks something like this.
Yeah.
I didn't say it was right, though. Okay. What we find is that there's the greatest biodiversity is in the pond facies, which in fact is the facies with the most fluctuations in pH, temperature, water flow rate, and so on. But generally speaking, we can find that in the different facies, you find different types of microbes, chemolithotrophy, phototrophy, heterotrophy, microbes that, whose metabolism works on different principles. So what you conclude then is that the microbial ecology does track the geological facies, which is just what would occur if the microbial activity was essential to the degassing and the carbonic precipitation. On the other hand, this may also just indicate that microbes are passive markers of the water chemistry, so that needs to be understood. What we're doing right now is measuring the absolute abundances to determine quantitatively and understanding the water chemistry in detail to understand if there really are enough microbes to produce the precipitation. Now, what I haven't talked about, and I'm going to end in just a minute, is the way to model the macroscopic precipitation processes, and that I'm not going to talk about. But we have done laboratory work, and I'll just show you some very quick pictures, trying to reproduce the features that we've seen in the field in the laboratory. So these are experiments with just salt, which is supposedly nothing like what happens at the Yellowstone. And we've made a flow channel, precipitated salt down it, and tried to see what happens. We get shrubs, we get terraces, which look similar to the ones that you see at Yellowstone. This is a large-scale experiment that we have going, and we're doing other experiments which will actually reproduce the behavior of the real Yellowstone water chemistry. So what's next? Well, one thread is to look at the lab experiment and to understand the precipitation dynamics that happens there, which is interesting in its own right. We can play all sorts of games like color coding with food dye at different times, doing time-lapse photography, looking at the patterns, comparing them, looking at their correlation functions, comparing those with those at Yellowstone. We're also looking at surveying Yellowstone digitally, digital geology, looking at the fractal dimensions, trying to look at the correlation functions, and really trying to see if we can understand what the growth dynamics is. Now, here's an intriguing thing that I want to leave you with. These are things called stromatolites, which are generally thought to be biological structures. These are shrubs at Yellowstone National Park, which are these calcite aragonite shrubs. These are the shrubs that we get in our salt experiment. They all look very similar, and they also look very similar to what you get if you do DLA type of simulations in three dimensions. And in fact, there have even been attempts to try to look at the fluctuations in the layering and try to compute the power spectrum of those fluctuations with those that you see in stromatolites from the field. So there's a lot that can be done here from the point of view of both generic modeling of these growth processes as well as studying at the system with an excessive amount of realism. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you for your attention.
The little ripples on the front face of the ponds.
Yes.
There's an instability that occurs in icicles.
Yep, I know exactly. It is.
And it's claimed to also occur in stalactites. And it looks just like that.
I think I completely agree with you. I think
that's where it's coming from.
I think so. Yeah. Good.
And I have some nice pictures to show you of.
Okay, I'd love to see them. I'm aware of all the recent work on that, but I'd be happy to hear about your work. Thank you.
You said that in pond faces, The highest biodiversity is achieved when you have large fluctuations in pH, and, which is in general, in accord, generally speaking, in accord with the niche theory in ecology. Can you elaborate how these fluctuations favor high biodiversity?
I can't give you any non-trivial answer to your question. I mean, I've told you all I know about that particular aspect of it. It's absolutely something that needs to be studied. That's the thing that the microbial ecologists who are in our team are very interested in trying to understand better. But I agree with you. That's what it's telling us.
I'm trying to understand that it's a very complicated, interesting system, but the carbon 13 disequilibration shows you that you have a biological impact on the carbon, and I'm wondering what's the signature that there's something active biologically as opposed to the bugs just eating the carbon, changing the equilibration, and then it's all a passive geological process of precipitation.
Other indications that there's life activity is important as looking at diurnal fluctuations. So for example, if you look at between day and night, you'll see fluctuations in the growth rate. So circumstantially, it says that something that the microbes are doing while they're, say, photosynthesizing is affecting the precipitation dynamics.
So I guess Yellowstone wouldn't let you kill all the bugs in the spring.
Actually, we have permission to take a channel off one of these and blast it with UV radiation to try to do that. But we also want to do a controlled experiment in the lab to test that too.
More questions?
Yes.
You said you were going to get a talk on this later in the program.
Hopefully I will. Yeah, there are some equations, even things like the KPZ equation and things like that.
Oh, that.
But that's not my work though. But there are other people who. But your question is there a real opportunity for serious quantitative modeling? And the answer is yes. I'm absolutely convinced there is, because for the first thing that one can try to understand is the genetic nature of these patterns. And how to quantify their correlation. So we're actually taking digital maps of the whole area so that we can actually measure correlation functions. And I think that those things are the outcome of genetic growth processes where the biology is something that's beneath the level of description of the large scale modeling. So yeah, I think you can predict why you get these shapes, why you get the sort of space-time fluctuations that you do, and the interesting question is going to be, at what level do you actually have to include the life processes in order to be able to quantitatively describe what's going on?
Are there conferences where people discuss this issue? Is this a new emerging field where people for the first time are?
Yeah, this is a new emerging field. So I think there's at least this side of geomicrobiology that there's only a few people who are studying it. Most of the results in the field are in the last few years. Two or three years.
So the data needs to be gathered.
We're still gathering data.
Absolutely. So that's where it's okay.
This is not a mature field.
Because it seems to be different effect. What you need to understand some basic mutual relationships before you can even start to do a bad model, which is a good first step. Yeah.
That's right. There's some things that we can't model yet because we don't even know what's happening.
Even after the data. Yeah. All right. And then, so related to that is the time scale of the data. You said that this you show a picture and says it changes over 2 months. And there the scale of the pattern looked quite big. I've been at Pamukkale actually when I was 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
I traveled with friends because at this time the world was safer and I was able to travel in Turkey when I was 15 years old with two friends. And so I remember very well these paddies. So what scale changes over 2 months? What kind of scale?
Well, for example, a pond can completely dry up. So you may have an active drainage basin, which then just completely stops. Or you'll have, for example, a pond will actually advance significantly and obliterate a whole landscape that you're studying within that time period.
So meter scale changes in 2 months.
You get meters.
Okay, so there is hope for
growth. The growth rate is very, okay. It's not uniform, and so it grows very rapidly. Okay. We're actually doing time lapse photography.
So
try to document
because graduate student lifetime, you can get some reasonable data.
Only if you're a very unlucky graduate student.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.